From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. A Democratic member of Congress feels the Detroit debates show the candidates for president are making the same mistakes as 2016.
Democrats did a terrible job in 2016 in terms of campaigning. We didn't talk about issues that mattered to people.
Dollar General has more than doubled the number of stores in Michigan since 2010.
So they've added 30 more stores just since Thanksgiving.
Not every town is welcoming the dollar stores. We'll look at a trend in building rectangular wood frame multi-story apartment buildings that sometimes have huge splashes of color or other things to try to set them apart.
The architect's job then becomes to put the wrapper on the box.
The Detroit Heidelberg Project is undergoing some changes.
We're transforming from an arts installation created by one man now into an artist community.
Plus, we have auto news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Coming up later on the program, we'll talk about a trend in construction you might have noticed in your own community, stick construction apartment buildings. We'll also hear about why there are so many Dollar General stores going up in rural communities. But first, in Detroit last night, we had a second night of debate among Democrats who want to be their party's nominee for president. 20 candidates in all over the two nights. Here to talk about the debates is one of Michigan's Democratic members of Congress, Debbie Dingell. Welcome back to Stateside.
It's great to be here.
What's your overall impression of this lineup of candidates?
You know, we've got 20 people, different backgrounds, different perspectives. So it's great to see such a talented field of people running. I'm not sure we learned a lot in the last 2 days.
I was going to ask you if you heard anything new.
I think we've got to begin to get to a point that we're going to winnow it down. But I have 20 friends running for president.
Were there any clear standouts in your opinion of the candidates? Who performed well? Let me put it that way.
I'm not endorsed anybody for president,
right.
And I really am more interested in how other people react to these two nights of debates and to meeting these candidates and working with these candidates, because I think Democrats did a terrible job in 2016 in terms of campaigning. We didn't talk about issues that mattered to people. Nobody wanted to hear or believe that we weren't doing a good job until it was far too late.
Yeah, you were one of the people who said Michigan was going to be lost to Trump. What do these candidates need to do? What does the Democratic Party need to think about to win Michigan back?
Well, and I didn't see it the last two nights, quite frankly, on the stage here. I think there were too many. I have to agree with Andrew Yang, who said there were too many rehearsed shots and one-liners and not enough of substance and talking to people. And I think another thing that they did is that we kept looking back. So I agreed with Senator Bennett, who said, instead of talking about issues that are 50 years old, we should be talking about issues now because our schools do need to get better. You know, they were in the city of Detroit, which is coming back, but it's an urban city. Race continues to be an issue. We have an education system that's broken there and not working for the kids. Wish we could have heard more about that. Wish we could have heard more about manufacturing. Wish we could have heard about trade deals that ship jobs overseas, and now you're trying to get a new trade deal, but it's still allowing a blazer plant that was only sent to Mexico last August to pay $1.50 an hour. That's not a level playing field for a worker here in Michigan. Wish I'd heard him talk about pensions and people who worked a lifetime and thought they'd have a safe and secure retirement and now don't know that they will. Wish I had heard lots of healthcare costs talk. Don't think a lot of people understood it, even people that knew the issue well.
Kind of hard to sum up in 30 seconds or a minute or so.
But they could have talked about why people are paying so much for prescription drugs and what they're going to do to so that people don't have to pay that much.
A lot of the polling shows there's a lot of interest in more policy measures about climate change. We heard a little bit about climate change last night. Did we hear anything that you think is substantive?
I think that everybody on that stage both nights all agree that we've got a serious environmental problem. I think it's so complex that you got to break it into different issues. So you've got the Paris Climate Accord. We've got what do we need to do about setting goals for carbonless society? What does that mean to everyday people? What does that mean to jobs? That's the bigger picture. Do we go off fossil fuels? Do we go off of coal? But we're in Michigan. More than 20% of the fresh water in the world is in the Great Lakes. People are worried about water quality. We have to worry about PFAS. We have to worry about lead in water. Flint is a symbol, but do you know how many schools across the country have lead in their water that our young children are drinking from? So there wasn't enough on the environment at all. Any sort of touches were to say Flint was outrageous. We need to talk about these issues, and we need to divide them up into chunks that get at each of these different issues.
Let's talk about the overall impressions. What do you think voters are thinking after watching two nights of Democrats attack other Democrats, tearing down their policies and sometimes their character?
I hope that the next debate, we're going to talk about the future and more about issues and less about attacking each other.
There is this divide between more moderate Democrats and the party's progressives. Will Democrats support the nominee no matter who wins because they didn't in 2016?
I am someone who believes that what's great about these 20 candidates is that they're people with different life experiences, different perspectives, and you bring all of that talent and knowledge to the table, which is what you do in the Congress and the Senate. The strength of any team is that each person has a different strength. But the team wins when you pull all those strengths together and row in the same direction. I think too many people didn't realize, nobody thought we could lose. Everybody thought Democrats were going to win, except for a few of us. I think people now know what's at stake, and I'm hope that that's going to be enough impetus that everybody's going to be rowing in the same direction.
You touched on it a bit here, but I wonder what you want to see next time in a debate from the candidates.
I want to see them talk about issues that matter to working men and women across this country. I think the Detroit debate was an opportunity to talk about heartland issues because any road to the White House for 2020 for both parties is going to go through the heartland. Working people across this country, no matter what state they live in, want to be able to get a job, make enough money to buy a home or to live in a safe and secure neighborhood, to be able to afford food, to be able to educate their kids. If they're sick, be able to go to the doctor. And when it comes time to retire, to have a safe and secure retirement. Those are really basic issues. We need to be talking about those more in a very simple language that everybody understands.
Debbie Dingell is the U.S. Representative for Michigan's 12th District. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
In my town, a Dollar General store is being built. It's almost finished. That will make the third Dollar General within 5 miles of my house. And there's a Family Dollar just down the street. Crane's Detroit business reporter Chad Livengood has noticed this expansion of Dollar General in many parts of rural Michigan, and he joins us now. Hi there, Chad.
Good afternoon.
So in your front page story, you tell us you find not every small town is thrilled about this big expansion of these dollar stores. Well, what's the concern?
Yes, I was up in Curtis, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula, about 70 miles from the Mackinac Bridge, for a weekend getaway up in June. And I noticed all these signs in town, I support Dollar General or boycott Dollar General. And I said, wait a minute, there's a Dollar General coming to Curtis, Michigan. It's a pretty small town. The township itself is 1,000 people. And sure enough, there was this Dollar General under construction on the west end of town, 9 miles from US 2, kind of on the way to nothing. You know, curiosity set in as a reporter. And I followed up, but I got back for vacation and started kind of calling around and looking around. And sure enough, Dollar General is in a massive, rapid expansion nationwide, but specifically in rural northern Michigan. And they are moving out into various areas. Back in November, they opened their 500th store in Ida,
right,
in the farming community of Monroe County.
You put this in perspective. Back in 2010, there were 247 Dollar General stores, and now more than 500. So what's the strategy of this company?
The strategy is to be, you know, small and nimble, get to people where they live or where they're driving. And they're not so concerned about, you know, being 5 miles away from the next one. So, for example, on US 23 going up the Sunrise side where I travel to Oscoda, there is a new one going up in the town of Omer. Omer is touts itself as Michigan's smallest city. There's 300 people live there. There's not a stoplight. There's really not any other type of commerce or store. There's a church, basically. But it's catching people driving up U.S. 23. And then there's one 7 miles away from there in Augray. Although there's a intersection before Augray to go up M65 kind of into the Huron National Forest. And it seems that they basically have planted this new store in Omer to sort of catch the people who turn left. So this company is very strategic in how they're placing these stores. They got 530. So they've added 30 more stores just since Thanksgiving. And the company nationally is adding nearly 1,000 stores this year. Their CEO has said that they think they, even at 15,500 stores now nationwide, the largest retailer by store count in the country, Dollar General, they think there's capacity for 12,000 more. So that's why they're going to towns that you wouldn't expect to see them, like in Curtis, Michigan.
How does this business plan make any sense, though? You've got the cost of the building, you've got the cost of the personnel to operate the store, and the goods. And when you're talking about a small town of 300 or less than 1,000, I would think they would never recoup their investment and their basic product cost and personnel cost.
Well, part of the strategy is that you have to, undercut the competition like anything else. And so I talked to the one small grocer in the town of Curtis, and he basically had already figured out from talking to his bread distributor and his milk distributor that Dollar General was going to be buying milk and selling milk at the price that he buys it at. Their selling price is going to be the price that he can buy it at. So it's all about trying to basically, use the sort of Walmart mass buying model and then selling lower than what your average mom and pop store could support. And so, there's been communities that question this. Now, when I found like up in Leelanau County, there's been some pretty successful efforts so far to stop Dollar General from coming in. The town of Maple City, Empire near the Sleeping Bear Dunes, their planning commission 4 years ago blocked one of these. And then just last month, there was a new attempt by Dollar General to buy a piece of land on the bucolic M22. And the village council held a special meeting to basically pass a 6-month moratorium on any new commercial construction, essentially trying to block Dollar General again.
So final question, Chad, how many Dollar General stores are planned for Michigan?
No, the company won't say that. Nationwide, they've said they're going to add 975 this calendar year. But like I said, they've added 30 just in the last 9 or 10 months. And it seems like they're going to poise to do a couple dozen more here just down the road, just based on reports around the state.
Chad Livengood is senior editor with Crane's Detroit Business. Good to talk to you.
As always, thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk about why new apartment buildings seem to look so similar. One person I know calls them ticky-tacky. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. A couple of weeks ago, an apartment building opened up in the Corktown neighborhood in Detroit, right where Tiger Stadium used to stand. And here's the thing. The apartment building looks a lot like a lot of other apartment buildings I've seen built in the last 5 years. You can see them in Detroit, Grand Rapids. There are a couple in Lansing, East Lansing. And I'm not the only person to notice this new architectural style. Justin Fox has too. He's a columnist with Bloomberg, and he wrote about it, and he joins us now. Justin, welcome.
Great to be talking to you.
So you write that these same kind of apartment buildings are popping up all across the nation. Describe what a typical downtown version of this type of building looks like.
It's 5 stories, sometimes up to 7, especially on the West Coast. It often fills up an entire block, tends to be very boxy. This really varies by region, but in a lot of places, there's a lot of use of bright colors, sometimes to sort of break up the facade, although in certain parts of the country, like in Texas and in a lot of the Midwest, although that Corktown building, I couldn't totally tell what they covered it with, but brick facades are common too. And out in the West Coast, it's always stucco, but often with bright colors. There's usually, at least if it's downtown, there's probably restaurants or other shops in the ground floor, or at least space intended for that. A lot of developers complain that they can't actually rent that space out, but the cities want them to do it.
What I see is big colored squares on a board game, or maybe it's like a scattered Rubik's Cube or something like that. Now, what do you call this architectural style?
I drove across the country last fall, and that's when I first started realizing that these things were everywhere. And I, you know, in terms of architectural style, there's a guy who called them, writing about some developments in Washington, called them fast casual, which I sort of like, but he actually was referring to a somewhat different kind of building. And when I started asking around, what it turned out to be the thing that they most have in common is actually the part that you can't see, which is that they're made of lightweight wood frames, basically the way single-family houses are.
Right. This whole new, or not new, actually, it's 150 years old, but it's a different kind of construction being used. So how does this differ from what we used to use in materials and in building style?
Well, you know, apartment buildings were usually in cities, and big cities in the U.S. and in Europe had big fires. And so over time, increasingly, they turned away from wood in construction. I mean, there have been partial bans on wood in construction in New York City, I think, since the early 1700s. And these sort of got codified on a nationwide level in the early 1900s. Apartment buildings had to be made of masonry, concrete, steel, and single-family houses were still made of wood frames. And what finally started happening around mid-century, as people were building apartment complexes, they were increasingly being built out in sort of suburban areas. They were low-slung, smaller things, so they built them with wood frames too. And over time, the housing code has changed in ways that have allowed them to build them up to 7 stories is the max.
You can't blame the developer. I mean, you can build cheaper but still charge the same rent as if you were a masonry building, right?
Right. And there's a flexibility to it. It makes it easier to string all the wires and HVAC and everything through the buildings. It's become the default method of residential construction in the U.S., so there are a lot more people who know how to do it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if this construction is so much cheaper in materials and in labor, why haven't developers been using this sooner?
To some extent, it's fads and fashion. To some extent, it's that the building code didn't allow it, really. I mean, these taller buildings, you know, another term for them that I found as I started digging into these was 5/1, which it's both an arcane reference to parts of the building code where there's type 5 structures and type 1, but it's also just 5 stories of wood over 1 story of concrete. That was pioneered in California in the 1970s. Because of possibly inadvertent building code changes? I don't know. I mean, it's partly that as sprinklers became widely used, building code officials got comfortable with allowing wood frame buildings to get a little taller. The 3 different national, regional organizations that were in charge of building codes merged in the late 90s and created a national code, and they basically took the West Coast rules on these apartment buildings, which were more permissive than the rest of the country, and adopted them nationwide. And that became the new rule in the early 2000s. What happened after that is kind of a boom in construction in cities. I mean, Detroit is one of the most dramatic examples of that, inner city where there hadn't been new residential construction in a really long time, suddenly has a lot of it, and now there was this ability to do it in this new way.
Let's talk about the environmental impact, because wood, at least, is renewable. Manufacturing, concrete, masonry, they're big producers of carbon dioxide, which, of course, is a greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. That would seem to be an advantage as well. Is that contributing to the popularity of this shift in how we construct apartment buildings?
I mean, it's definitely something that both the wood products industry and the housing industry have been pushing, and I think they're not making it up. I've read a lot of scientific studies that generally agree with this idea that depending on how the forests are managed, what they're replanted with after you chop down the wood to build buildings with it, that it can be much closer to carbon neutral or even carbon positive than other building materials. So, yeah, that's part of it, and it's also pushing a sort of worldwide trend towards trying to use different kind of wood construction, which is mainly lots of little pieces of wood glued together to create tall buildings. I think the tallest are now up to about 18 stories. There's one
wow.
in British Columbia, and there are a couple in Scandinavia that are built that way. But they're different. I think there's a lot of uncertainty about how long glued together wood will stay glued together, but in general, they don't have some of the other, they're less flimsy, I guess you could say, than these lightweight wood frame buildings, which is what we're getting mainly in the U.S.
So I understand that this wood is somehow made of fire resistant or fireproof, and God knows what chemical that is. Is it still, though, a risk? Because, I mean, we saw Chicago burn down because it was an all-wood building city.
Yeah, I mean, when these buildings are under construction, they're unbelievably flammable, especially out on the West Coast, but really all over. There have been tons of building fires related to these lightweight wood frame apartment buildings. Once they're built, they all have sprinkler systems in there, which is, you know, more than most single-family houses do. So in that sense, they're reasonably safe. There was still one pretty terrible fire a while back just across the river from New York in a building that had sort of a partial sprinkler system, kind of an earlier version of these, a little shorter, and that burned down. There have been changes in the building code since then. There are definitely a lot of firefighters who were worried about this. They're especially worried that, you know, maybe 30 years down the road when some of these buildings have fallen on hard times and maybe something goes wrong with the sprinkler system, then they're total fire traps. I think once they're done, they're pretty safe.
I got one final question. I mean, this type of construction is cheaper. That does not mean they all have to look the same. How do you explain this exterior aesthetic?
Development in the U.S. is increasingly financed by big institutional investors like pension funds, foundations, stuff like that. And it's still more regional than lots of industries, but it's much more national than it used to be. And I do think, I mean, you know, every city in the U.S. that built a lot of housing in the 1920s has a bunch of craftsman-style bungalows. We all think they look magnificent now, but there were people back then complaining about bungalow disease and the sameness of all the new development. So to a certain extent, every kind of new, I mean, and McMansions, they all look the same all over the country. So there's a certain kind of tendency of the building industry always to do this.
What do you think about the way they look?
I mean, I like a lot of them. They're more interesting than apartment building. Well, for one thing, in a lot of these cities where I've seen these things going up, there had been no new apartment buildings in a really long time. And, the ones from back in the 20s and 30s are pretty cool looking. But most apartments built in the 50 years after that aren't super interesting to look at. And some of these are going to look terrible in 15 years. The color is going to fade and whatever. But there are really cool looking ones. There's one in Boise that I didn't actually see on my trip, but I've seen pictures of since. That's this really creative use of the kind of freedom that this building technique allows. So I don't dislike them as much as most people do, but I will say I live in a city, New York, where there aren't any because they're still not allowed here.
Right.
So maybe it's easy for me to say. I just see them when I'm on vacation or otherwise traveling.
Justin Fox is a columnist with Bloomberg. Good talking to you.
Great being on with you.
Let's turn now to an architect who might be able to tell us more about this new apartment building aesthetic. Kit McCullough is a lecturer at the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. Kit specializes in urban design and real estate development. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So why do so many of these new apartment buildings look so similar?
Well, I actually teach a course at the university on real estate development for architects and planners, where we try to answer this very question. And I think a lot of it has to do with the development process. These buildings are formulas, and like most formulas, they're the most efficient response to a set of constraints. Zoning codes, building construction, safety codes, and finance all push towards the same design answer to the problem.
But how does that result in big, colorful squares plastered across
the
building?
So then, you know, by the time the architect is brought in, most of the building's already been figured out, the size, the shape, how it's laid out.
So this is the only way an architect can express
exactly.
Themselves.
The architect's job then becomes to put the wrapper on the box. And they try to break up this big box by changing materials or with window placement and size. And so that becomes the design problem.
So when you're designing a building, how does that shape the identity or the culture of a city?
So these design responses do, I think, vary by regions. In the Southwest, you'll see mostly stucco. Fake stucco. In Ann Arbor, there's a sense that the public will be more accepting of a building that's brick. The designs tend to be very staid. In Detroit, Maurice Cox, the director of planning there, has said explicitly that good design is a requirement for development in Detroit. And so, and he's been bringing in national and international architects. So the design there, I think, is of a higher quality.
In your profession, are there a lot of like focus groups or do you base it on interactions with community members or maybe even your students? How do you know what draws them aesthetically to a building or an area of a city for that matter?
Well, we do have this conversation with my students. What parts of Ann Arbor do you like best? And they're all drawn to Carytown.
For folks who are not from Ann Arbor, okay. What is Carytown?
So it's a very mixed district right adjacent to downtown. It's where the farmers market is. There's lots of commercial uses and retail as well as housing. Much of it is a historic district. So the environment's very diverse and a very small scale. It has a much finer grain than what we see downtown where the buildings are bigger and taller.
And even in the retail center there, it's almost unpredictable when you walk in. You kind of have to negotiate how to get around and what shop to find and things like that.
And this is what makes for an interesting urban environment, is when you have lots of entrances and activities, stoops and porches and shop fronts. So I think one thing cities can do with these larger boxy apartment buildings is to require more entrances, require active uses on the ground floor. Don't let parking be part of the streetscape.
A lot of cities are requiring a retail level, and that doesn't always work if it's not densely populated enough. Why should government get involved in a decision like that, I guess is what I would want to ask.
So many cities, Detroit's looking at this, are using what's called a form-based code. It's a zoning code that specifies the design and not the use. Most zoning codes say it has to be retail. The design form-based code says you have to have entrances, you have to have windows, you have to have stoops or porches, and they can be residential, they can be retail. You can't have parking garages on the street. They have to be underground or behind the building. And so this, I think, is a way to make a better designed, more active and human-scaled environment.
Why in Europe do the buildings all kind of look the same, but people still find them really pleasing, aesthetically pleasing?
In Paris, they're big, boxy, blocky buildings. They all look alike, and no one complains. It's a beautiful urban environment. And I think that goes to the scale of design. So again, these buildings have lots of entrances, active uses on the ground floor, cafes. They also have a design at the level of detail. So the windows are beautifully detailed. The materials are beautifully detailed. Very nice materials. They're not fake stucco. You know, they were built in an era when building construction was much different and was a much bigger investment.
We talked a little earlier with the other guest about this shift from concrete block structures to wood structures. Are there any concerns? Do you have any concerns in using this material?
No, and again, that also comes from building codes. The most affordable way to build a building is with lightweight stick construction. So it's a way to keep building costs down.
Is this apartment building aesthetic that we're seeing right now, again, with these big colorful squares, that's not the only thing they do, but that's the one we see a lot around here. Is this going to be one of those 10-year trends, or will those big colorful squares on apartment buildings stick around for a while longer?
I don't think the need for apartments is going to go away. I do think there's innovation in construction methods. So we're going to see more fabricated, manufactured building components. I think this will change the aesthetics of buildings in the future.
So what do you think of this trend? I mean, do you like it? Do your students like it?
I would say the design is uninspired and
Uninspired.
Yeah,
you said.
And I actually teach a design studio where I try to push the students to break out of the formula, to push the formula within the existing constraints of finance and building codes, but to come up with a better response. But it's difficult. It really is the most efficient way to provide housing in our downtowns. And I would say, for the most part, that is a good thing. We have more people living in downtown Ann Arbor. This is good. We have more people who are living close to our major job centers so they can walk to work. We have more people supporting retail downtown. We need to provide more housing, and we need to provide apartments, because most of the population now are young singles or empty nesters. And so we need housing for that demographic. And this is a way to provide it.
Kit McCullough is a lecturer at the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university.
Still to come, we'll recap the second night of the Democratic primary presidential debates in Detroit. We'll talk to Michigan Radio's political analyst Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. They were both there. They'll give us their takeaways. Also, we'll talk with Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes about the emissions agreement that Ford got in on, bypassing the Trump administration.
I'm told by people close to the situation that, you know, this isn't about a political snub to the president. This is trying to get this process moving forward instead of it ending up in litigation.
That is next on Stateside. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. The Trump administration wants to cut fuel economy targets and strip California of its exemption, allowing it to set its own emission standards. There are some automakers basically ignoring what President Trump wants. Joining us to explain the who, what, and why is Detroit business columnist Daniel Howes. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
So Ford, Volkswagen, BMW, and Honda struck this deal with California about how to go about reducing emissions. So what's the problem with that?
Well, the problem, and I'm not even sure that it is a problem, but what it does do is it leaves out, you know, the elephant in the room, as it were, and that's the federal government. California has an exemption under the Clean Air Act to set its own emission standards. And the Trump administration essentially says, we're going to strip you of that ability, which it was going to land this whole thing, you can make book on it, is going to land it in federal court. And I think what the car companies are very concerned about is they've got a lot of balls in the air right now. You know, we've got a pretty good market of the traditional car and truck and SUV business. You've got big bets they're having to make on electrification. You've got tariffs out there that are undercutting, raising their costs and undercutting their ability to compete in certain markets. And now you lay on top of it the uncertainty of a big Donnybrook between California and the federal government over fuel economy standards. And what the car companies want is one single standard. So they're not building one set of cars and vehicles for 35 states and another for 15 states in California. And I think that's the real challenge.
We all know that corporations want certainty. That makes sense. Why make this deal with California, though, if this doesn't really help them get to certainty?
Because I think they are hoping that the federal government will become part of the discussion and that they can all kind of agree. Remember, these are the, as it stands right now, these are the Obama era standards that they're talking about. So they've negotiated down a little bit, and without getting into a bunch of numbers, I'll just say they've negotiated back a little bit from the Obama standard, but much higher than the standard that the Trump administration is proposing, which would be a rollback of the Obama era standards going to 2025. So they're trying to cut what they think is a more achievable deal given market conditions and technological considerations and the prices of fuel and oil and all sorts of other things, and hoping that the Trump administration will become part of the discussions.
Well, you write that these automakers are making these investment decisions risking political reprisals from the president. What kind of reprisals?
Well, President Trump, as anybody within the sound of our voices knows, is not afraid to use Twitter to beat companies about the head and shoulders. And I think the auto companies have been one of his favorite targets, depending on the issue. Ford Motor Company is obviously the most prominent, is the American company prominent in this group that, you know, has decided to take a risk here. And I'm told by people close to the situation that, you know, this isn't about a political snub to the president. This is trying to get this process moving forward instead of it ending up in litigation. Because if it ends up in litigation, they're going to be sitting on the sidelines and they're not going to really know what kind of regulatory environment they're dealing with. And this is it's a very expensive proposition. It's technologically demanding. And this is all landing as they're going through probably the biggest transformation and transition in the industry, certainly in any of our lifetimes. You know, I've recently talked to a CEO of one of the car companies who said, this change is going to come. Now, we can't tell you if it's going to be 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, but it's going to come. And the regulatory environment around the world is also changing and at a faster pace than the United States. And so what the companies are now faced with the situation is that they're going to have one regulatory scheme in the U.S. and another one in places like the EU and China. And that undercuts their ability to compete globally, because what they want to be able to do is use global scale, build the same kind of products for all markets around the world. That's how you manage higher costs. And electrification, at least in the near term, is going to be more expensive than internal combustion engines.
There's not been a huge demand for electric vehicles, though. I mean, you wrote about the recent video from Ford that was designed to show the power of the new electric F-Series pickup. Why make those investments? Why take that chance when we still haven't seen a demand from the people?
That's a great question. And I think it comes down to really one word, and that's regulators. The biggest markets in the world are moving ahead. The cities in Europe are banning diesel engines from the center cities. Some of them are moving ahead and will, at some date certain in the future, 15 or so years out, ban internal combustion engines altogether. Gas, diesel, you name it, not going to be in the cities. Electrification is coming. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to come to everybody's driveway. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to be driving an electric vehicle. But I don't think there's any question that in China, the regulators who have a lot of power are essentially legislating internal combustion engines out of existence. And at some point, the car companies have got to have some certainty as to what's happening. And they know what's happening with the regulators in other parts of the world. Here, it's very politically driven. It's a very partisan process. And the car companies, I think, are showing that they understand where the market is going. And I think the Trump administration has a very different view than the Obama administration. And if President Trump is to lose to a Democrat in next year, and by 2021, you could be back in a different situation because you have a different administration controlling the EPA and setting regulations. And that's part of the problem with our system here is it does tend to yaw back and forth. And these companies have got to manage it, and it can be very tricky.
Daniel Howes is columnist and associate business editor of the Detroit News. You can hear him regularly here on Stateside. Thanks.
You bet.
Conversation has been buzzing for a while about the possible closure and removal of the long-standing Heidelberg Project. The organization in charge of the art installation on Detroit's east side says it's not going anywhere, but its mission is evolving and expanding. A new chapter starts today with the opening of its headquarters on Heidelberg Street.
The Heidelberg Project has had lots of challenges and controversies and struggles. But what's phenomenal about it is that it's still standing today. I'm Janine Whitfield, and I am the president of the Heidelberg Project. I've been involved with the organization. I'm going into my 26th year. The best way to describe the process of what's happening now is that we're transforming from an arts installation created by one man now into an artist community that is impacted by many artists, stakeholders, and residents within the neighborhood. We've always wanted to have our headquarters on Heidelberg Street. We just haven't been able to. So we bought this building, and it's a beautiful building. It's like a campus. We have a building, we have a house, and we have six lots. And that's just going to allow us to activate this area more. So inside the Numbers House, for example, this is going to be our first artist-in-residence studio. It's also going to be like a space where we'll be working with kids that we're working with in the Heidelberg Arts and Leadership Academy. So the idea is that you're taking what we started 33 years ago to the next level. Mm-hmm. And like the city of Detroit is transforming and changing and evolving, so are we. We're going to shift and change and evolve as the culture is shifting and changing and evolving around us.
Michigan Radio intern Katie Raymond produced that story. You can learn more about what Janine Whitfield calls Heidelberg 3.0 and see pictures of the buildings and art installations at michiganradio.org. The two nights of debate among the 20 Democratic candidates for president in Detroit disappointed a lot of people. They wanted more substance, more talk about issues important to them, and fewer rehearsed gotcha moments. Here to go over the highlights and lowlights of the debate are Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. Hi there.
Hello.
Go easy on us, kid.
I don't have a better idea, but having 10 people on the stage questioned by three moderators would seem to inhibit any chance of a deep discussion.
Lester. That's enough. Your time's up.
Most of them got about 7 minutes to speak during the hour squabble, or at least the lower rung ones.
Yeah.
What did you think of the debate format?
Well, look, I mean, it's unruly and it is messy because, as you said, there are 10 folks up there, more than half of which realize they need to get those jabs in. They want that 8-second sound bite because they know that that's what's going to keep them in the race. So unruly was sort of the order of the day.
I mean, yeah, they were there to, knock some of the contenders off. And we know that there will be, fewer contenders going forward. But, look, it's speed dating. And, we knew that.
Tom Perez said as much in the opening before the debate. The DNC chair basically said, speed date tonight. Fall in love. Fall in love with more than one candidate.
Well, let's talk about that, because did any of the candidates actually stand out from the others because of the debates?
Well, I hate to say, the chattering class is saying, but I think if you look at folks in D.C. and what they're talking about is that Cory Booker sort of came off as the happy warrior, and he really was one of those candidates that needed to make an impression in order to kind of stay in the race, right? And then the first night, Marion Williamson, for good or for bad, I read a statistic that actually in 49 states, she was the most Googled candidate.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and of course, a Michigander herself. In fact, I thought this was so Michiganian, Michigander
well, not
of
a,
her.
Not a Michigander per se, but she did have a church
but
in Gross
Point. But she knows Detroit so much that, it was at the Fox Theater. Well, walking into the Fox Theater, right next to the theater is the Fillmore, and guess who had bought advertising space billboard on the Fillmore? No other candidate thought to do that.
So the traditional Democrats versus the progressives fight, how much did these debates throw more gasoline on that dumpster fire?
Right, more gasoline and then more lit matches, more gasoline and more lit matches.
I'm gonna disagree.
Okay.
Look, we said speed dating. This is a sorting out process where Democrats know who these people are and more or less where they stand in the spectrum. And so they're going to have this debate about whether or not they want a centrist who is supposedly more electable by a peer, by appealing to the muddling middle, or someone who's a passionate progressive. And this was a chance to kind of test out both of those and then decide, which way they might be, they might be leaning.
And I think it was also fully on display, right? Because both nights, for at least the first 30 to 40 minutes was about healthcare, which when you look at the Democratic Party, there's big divisions there, right? And Medicare for all. So especially last night with Biden and Harris talking so much. So, if you were only watching for the first half an hour, 45 minutes, because that's all you could handle, you saw those splits because there are splits within the party about very specific issues.
Well, and also records, we've got some people in here who are very new, who don't have political histories that can be attacked. And then there are some who have very long political histories. And it did seem like there was a sustained sustained effort to just kind of push Joe Biden off the stage. But, I mean, any
he's been leading in the polls. So there's a reason for that, right?
Right,
let's knock him off his pedestal.
But any candidate who does that had better be careful, because when you're attacking Joe Biden's record as vice president, at least, that means you're also attacking the beloved President Barack Obama.
And they were critical of the Obama administration, which was surprising, considering he is, as you said, beloved by the Democrats.
And there are a lot of Democrats that I am hearing from this morning that were concerned, because it sure felt to them that a lot of time was spent talking about how Democratic policies put forward by various candidates are bad, instead of taking the time about spending time talking about the current president and the Republican. Now, this is what Democrats are saying. You know, there are plenty of Republican strategists that are like, keep at it. Keep at the infighting.
And I think Joe Biden in particular, when he was especially, you know, facing down Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, to some degree, Cory Booker as well, was trying to present himself as the candidate schooled in the art of the possible, which you can talk about, you know, your grand policy dreams as much as you want, but you have to get them through the Congress, through the bureaucratic system, you know, anything like that. And he was trying to pull that off. I don't know that he did it particularly effectively.
One of the things I noticed, and a few candidates that did this, they kind of had this reset moment, like, hey, any one of us is going to be better than the current president.
That was said multiple times.
And it was like, it was almost like a reminder to the other candidates on the stage, who were getting a little rough here.
Yeah,
getting rough
usually said either right before or right after someone shibbed someone there on the
I've said this before on this program, so I'll make it a quick story. But I went to school for a little while in England, and I was in a political science class, and they were absolutely shocked by the idea that we had primaries. This is not something they do. They're like, wait, let me understand this. For a year, candidates of the same party go after each other. Then they choose one candidate to go after. How does that make sense?
And not only that, but then they get up on a stage the next morning.
And endorse
the other one.
Well, talking about endorsements, have Democrats in Michigan coalesced around one candidate or another?
I think Democrats in Michigan, politicians in Michigan, are very much like the American electorate, which is no. We are, just this past week, though, seeing a couple. We saw Congressman Andy Levin come out for Elizabeth Warren this week, and we saw Brenda Lawrence come out for Kamala Harris. And then a few weeks ago, Mike Duggan, the mayor of Detroit, of course, has been a big Joe Biden fan. But we did hear from Governor Whitmer and the lieutenant governor, who both said it is too early. We are still going to speed date. Whitmer didn't even say whether or not she will endorse before Michigan's primary. So both of them are holding out.
And earlier in the show, we heard from Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, who just said, I have 20 friends up there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that actually, for Debbie Dingell, that's true.
this is classic Debbie Dingell, you know, hair pulling, because she is so afraid that these primaries are going to get so fractious that Democrats are not going to be able to coalesce afterwards to, get ready for November.
So the early caucuses and primaries are going to winnow out some of these candidates down to a more manageable number, but New Hampshire isn't until February. The Republicans have their candidate. He's already campaigning. How helpful is it to the Democrats if they have this gaggle of candidates attacking each other and no one really stands out
for another
couple of months?
The DNC rules are going to winnow out the field for the debates, that you've got to be polling at least 2% in some of the polls, have 130,000 individual donations. I mean, as of right now, I think, let me look at my list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there are only 7 candidates out of the 20 who are there who would qualify right now for the next debate.
Any last words, Zoe?
Buckle in. It's a wild ride. We've got something like 220 days now until the Michigan primary. So
these election seasons get longer and longer.
This thing ain't over.
You guys love this.
Oh, my gosh.
There are some of us who are not thrilled with it.
Absolutely.
God, what?
We're sick, Lester. We're sick people. Right.
There's a reason
I just
call
draft
you
on her enthusiasm.
The resident political junkie.
There's, I love it.
I know I you do, it. But I'm just like, oh, how much longer do we have to deal with this? Okay, that's Rick Pluta. He reports for the Capitol, from the Capitol. Zoe Clark is our resident political junkie, as I mentioned. Thanks very much, you two. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks, Lester. And when does the debate start tonight?
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll talk to a professor from Michigan State University who studied police shootings and has some surprising results. And we'll talk to a writer who's working this summer on Isle Royale.
I don't worry about email. Nobody's texting me. Or if they're texting me, I'm not getting them. You know, I'm not getting on Facebook. Yeah, I feel free of all that crap. It feels good.
That sounds just about perfect. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.